We will resume council meeting. We will be dealing with 3.2 municipal pension plan review. And today we have Jennifer Urquhart and Philip Churchill with us today. They're going to give us a presentation and hopefully allow us to ask a few questions.
For sure.
Did you say you're going to sit or stand?
Oh, I'm going to sit.
I'm setting the tone, so if he wants to sit, I'll start by sitting.
Yeah.
Just talk to them.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, no trouble. Okay. See if I can reach that mic. Can you all hear me? Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay, my name is Jennifer Urquhart, and this is my colleague Philip Churchill. We're here from ACLR. We've been the pension plan actuaries for a number of years now. Myself and Derek Gerard have really worked on it year to year to year. And Philip's here because he's really a subject matter expert of what we're talking about today, and that's the opportunity to transition into the public sector, public service superannuation plan for the province of Nova Scotia. So how we're planning to do this today is I'm going to talk to you a little bit about the pension plan and the history and how we got to where we are. Then I'm going to hand it to him because, like I said, he really does know his stuff and is able to present all the key considerations. So we'll start it off like that. And this is really the agenda, what I just said we were going to go through. The other point on the agenda that I will point out is not only will I talk about kind of how we got to today, but there is Nova Scotia pension funding reform. So these are changes to the Pension Benefits Act that are going to impact how much money is required for pension plans, not just the region of Queens plans, but plans for, throughout the province. So 11 years ago, the way that this pension plan was decided to be managed was a rate stability approach was put in place. And what that meant was really, when we do an actuarial valuation every single year, it establishes the minimum amount of contributions that need to go in a pension plan. So that's the minimum. You can imagine, depending on what happens, how good the year has been, and some different pension rules, the minimum amount of contributions can fluctuate year to year to year to year. What was decided was, okay, how about this? How will we pick a rate that's higher than the minimum? What that's going to do is it's going to minimize those fluctuations year to year to year. But the other benefit of that is maybe we can build up a cushion or kind of a surplus in this pension plan, and we can spend that to improve benefits. Plus, it paid down any deficit faster in the pension plan, because generally you have a certain amortization term to pay down any deficits, about 15 years. But those deficits would be paid down faster, plus it might build a cushion, plus it would minimize any contribution volatility. This is great, and it's really worked well for the pension plan. Like I said, it's been 11 years and really quite successful. However, we get to the most recent valuation was done at the end of 2018. And basically, where we are now is there is no deficit in the pension plan. It's basically a wash. The assets are enough to cover the liabilities. And the cost of benefits going to be earned next year is about what the contribution is going into the pension plan. There's a 1% of payroll cushion in there, but there's not much room. So we can say current contributions are sufficient to make requirements, and that's very good. But what's making us a little bit nervous right now is there's not a whole lot of margin. All that cushion that we thought we had 11 years ago has disappeared, and the reason for that is long-term interest rate expectations, so the rate we expect the pension plan to earn in the coming years has gone down, so we have to use a different rate of return assumption, so that makes the cost of benefits going in a little bit higher. And then also contribution rules, minimum funding rules are changing. So the next actual valuation we're going to do, we have to do annual valuations for this pension plan, is at the end of 2019. So this rate stability, like I said, there's a 1% buffer that can cover about a $300,000 deficit. So if the pension plan loses kind of $300,000, that rate stability in there is no longer going to be sufficient. There's not much margin. The other thing that we do as actuaries is we set assumptions for the pension plan. So we set assumptions on how long we think people are going to live, when they're going to retire, and that big one is the rate of return we expect the pension fund to earn long term. And we do that, but we also, when we set that interest rate, we try to be a little bit conservative. So if we expect this pension fund, I'll tell you, to earn about 5.75 per year for the long term. That's our best estimate. And then what we'll do is we'll say, okay, let's not use 5.75 as an estimate. Let's use something a little bit lower, just to be a little bit more conservative. So we use 5.5. We have a 25 basis point margin for conservatism, and that's not being very conservative in our world. That's being like just sort of conservative, but there's that in there too. At the end of the day, all these actuarial techniques, so anything we can defer investment loss by asset smoothing, different stuff like that, that doesn't really impact when the pensions are going to be paid. That's just different things we can do to impact that minimum contribution that has to go into the pension plan. Now, that's where we are today. So we just did the actuarial valuation under the current rules. Contributions are sufficient, but there's not much buffer. And like I said, we're not being overly conservative when we use a 5.5% rate of return. Now, we also know that the Nova Scotia Pension Benefits Act is changing, and it's changing the rules what the minimum contributions have to be in the pension plan. Without going into too much detail of what's changing, the big thing that's changing is that conservatism that I'm telling you is in the rate right now. Is depicted differently in the way the rules are. We're going to be quite mandated in what we have to use for our conservatism, and we have to be more conservative. And as you can imagine, if we have to be more conservative, that minimum contribution that needs to go into the pension plan is higher. And we did a calculation to estimate what the impact of that could be. And when it all is said and done, we would think that if the rules are laid out like we think they are right now, contributions as they are right now wouldn't be sufficient. In fact, they'd have to increase overall by 1.6% of the payroll. So that rate stability is no longer enough under this scenario, and contributions would increase. So that is a very, very quick picture of kind of what we've done to date and really the situation, what it is right now, and why this is a bit of a pivotal moment. Pension reform, as far as timing goes, we don't know exactly when this is coming into play, other than it is coming. We don't know rules on how that's going to transition, but we expect that there will be a transition to the point where if we have to transition into this more conservative regime, there is going to be a little bit of time to do so, but they are coming. So this is something to kind of ponder on right now. But it brings us to this next opportunity. So Philip will talk about a little bit about how this opportunity came into play and really what it means and what it could mean to your employees and to the municipality.
Okay. Good? Done. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. I'm going to steal this.
Yeah, for sure.
So the Nova Scotia Public Service Superannuation Plan is now open, or oops, that's not working. I'm going to use this.
I was using that, yeah.
Okay. On the side. Oh, look at that. It's turned off. Okay. I'll turn it on. So what we're going to talk about today a little bit is a little bit about the Public Service Superannuation Plan. You'll hear me call it the PSSP throughout the presentation and probably when I'm talking as well. Some of the differences between the pension plans, between the PSSP and the Queen's Pension Plan. How this would all play out in terms of a transfer, if that were to happen, between the Queen's Pension Plan and the PSSP. And then some financial information, sort of, is it financially feasible to transfer? Are the assets in the Queen's Pension Plan sufficient to fund the benefits under the PSSP? And then a little bit of about next steps and how this would play out should you want to move forward with this transition. So just a little bit of a background. So the Queen's Pension Plan is a traditional defined benefit pension plan, what we consider just a traditional type of pension plan, where the ultimate responsibility to make contributions to fund the benefit is with the municipality. If the plan were to wind up at some point in the future and there weren't enough assets in the pension fund to meet all of the obligations of plan members, the obligation is on the municipality to fully fund the benefits. Okay? So at the end of the day, the municipality has the ultimate responsibility to meet the required benefit promises, the promises that they've made to their employees. And the first source of those of the funding for that promise is the pension fund. But if the pension fund wasn't sufficient to meet all of those promises, the region would be responsible, would be obligated to make an additional funding in order to meet those responsibilities. It's subject to the Nova Scotia Pension Benefits Act. So all the funding rules, as Jennifer was mentioning, are set in that document, in that act. You do have an exemption from funding the solvency deficit. That was something that came in, I think 7 or 8 years ago, when all pension municipal school boards and a few other pension plans were given an exemption from actually funding the solvency deficit, which is also the wind-up deficit. So you don't have to fund it, but if the plan were to wound up, you would be responsible for making those contributions. And as Jennifer mentioned, the funding rules are changing. We don't know when. We think the regulations are supposed to be introduced or brought or made public in the fall, but that was said in the spring, and who knows what happens. You know sometimes those things take a little longer than was expected. Again, as Jennifer mentioned, rate stability strategy has been employed and has worked well since 2009. Employees are contributing now 8.8%. The employer contributes 9.8%. If the rate stability approach wasn't enough, if the 9.8% or the total of 18.6, if the total 18.6 wasn't sufficient to meet the minimum requirements, right now the employer would be responsible for making up the deficit. The only time, the way that employee contributions change is through collective bargaining for the union groups. So the only way that the employee contribution would change would be through some sort of bargaining approach. Other than that, it's the employer's responsibility for making up that minimum contribution requirement. So, you know, as Jennifer mentioned as well, one of the goals of that rate stability approach was to build up some surplus in order to allow for some benefit improvements. The benefit improvement that typically happens in plans like this is what's called a base year improvement, right? Right now, every employee's pensions are 2% of each year's earnings, right? So the pension you earned in 2000 was based on your 2000 earnings, okay? Your pension you earned in 2018, 2019 is based on your 2018 and 2019 earnings. There's no inflation growth. There's no sort of ability for those older benefits to be sort of in today's dollars without a plan amendment to improve the benefits. Okay. So right now, members who earn benefits in 2000, their benefit is based on their 2000 earnings, their earnings in the year 2000. Now, one of the things when you've got that solvency exemption, one of the other requirements that was in the pension benefits legislation at the time was if you want to improve benefits, you need to fully fund, lump sum, the value of that improvement. So you might have $1 million in surplus on a going concern basis, but if you've got $1 of deficit on a solvency basis, you have to fully fund with cash the value of that benefit improvement. Okay? Which means, quite frankly, in most cases, all cases, you know, benefit improvement can't happen until that solvency position goes to positive, but you're not contributing anything to bring it to zero because you have an exemption from funding that deficit. So you're kind of in a quandary that you really can't improve benefits unless you want to make a significant lump sum contribution to the pension plan. The other thing we've noticed in recent years is lots of plan sponsors are hesitant to making benefit improvements because once you make them, they're permanent, right? And if we run into another 2008 where investment returns are such that the pension fund loses 10, 15%, you can't take it away. And now you've got to fund, not only do you have to fund your plan back to 100%, you also have to fund that benefit improvement that you made. So lots of plan sponsors are hesitant to make benefit improvements because once they're in the plan, they're there forever. So what are some of the key challenges that we see for plan members and employers? Now, this isn't just Queens, but DB plan sponsors in the public sector, the broader public sector, like you guys, What do we see some of the key challenges? Well, plan members, I'm sure, would love to have more benefits. They certainly would like to have their benefits improved in order to meet the inflation that's happened since the year in which they've earned that benefit. And they also, I'm sure, would want reasonable contribution rates, right? They don't want to be paying 15% for the pension benefits. It's part of their total package, and their take-home pay is very important. So I'm sure plan members, I'm sure, are very look at that contribution rate very closely and make sure that it's reasonable and affordable to them. So for an employer, for a plan, well, one of the big risks we see for single employer pension plans like yourself is just the financial risk and responsibility of running a pension plan. You know, you, staff, have better things to do than to run a pension plan. There's lots of other things you do in order to maintain, you know, the municipality. The pension plan is a big, complex beast and takes a lot of time and effort. Okay? And that comes with managing also the plan governance and administration responsibilities. You know, you have our help in terms of doing administration of the pension plan, but still, the Region of Queens Council is ultimately responsible for running that pension plan and making sure it's run in accordance with the pension regulations, the Act, and all that kind of thing. So we find lots of employers find that they want to move that responsibility to some other organization who may be bigger, better able to take on those responsibilities. So that you know, so and then the question is, you know, the pension fund, as Jen mentioned, there's $12.2 million in the pension fund. Is that sustainable? Can a pension fund that has $12.2 million and probably not going to be get that much bigger over the long term, really an efficient way to provide pension benefits to your employees? So we've done an analysis, compared the benefits and the public service superannuation plan to the Queen's pension plan in Appendix A. So I don't want to go into all the tables of comparisons, but they're in appendix to the presentation, so you can take a look at that at your leisure. The key one, as I've already mentioned, is the difference between the year-by-year accrual rate under the Queen's plan, which is 2%. So every year, plan members earn 2% of that year's earnings as a pension benefit. Under the PSSP, it's a different type of benefit design, and it's a 1.3% of earnings up to the YMPE, which is the CPP earnings base, so which is about $57,000 this year. So they earn 1.3% of earnings up to that $57,000, and 2% of earnings afterwards. But it's on the member's final average earnings. So every year, their benefit is improving if their earnings are growing. So every year, you look at the best five. So it's no longer looking at year 2000, 2001, 2002, 2003 in terms of earnings. Now in 2019, it will be looking at your 2015 to 2019 earnings. And those earnings are the ones that are used to determine your pension benefit. So we kind of think of that as there's pre-retirement indexing. So it's always maintaining its inflation protection, right? Because if earnings are growing with inflation, so are your pension benefits. So it's always maintaining, so it's allowing your benefits to always be sort of up to date, if you want to use those terms. Now, as mentioned, you know, the accrual rate's a little bit different, but the final average basis under which the PSSP is designed kind of eats into the difference in the accrual rates as time goes on. As those benefits, so 1.3% of your 2019 earnings very well could be better than 2% of your 2000 earnings. So there's potential for benefit improvements that way. Also, there's other benefits that are enhanced relative to the Queen's plan under the PSSP. Everybody gets an unreduced pension at age 60 under the PSSP, whereas under the Queen's plan, I think you have to have 15 years of service in order to have an unreduced pension at age 60. There's a rule of 80-85, depending upon when you started. That means if your age and service add up to 80 points or 85 points, if you were hired after 2011, you can retire with an unreduced pension without a penalty. So that means somebody who started at age 25 can likely retire when they get to 85 points, which would be before age 55, or at age 55, at 85 points. There's an additional pension that's payable to age 65, so somebody who retires prior to 65 actually gets a pension of 2% of their final average earnings until they turn 65, and then it drops down to the 1.3 and 2. Kind of the idea there, it's what we call integrated with Canada Pension, because Canada Pension was expected to start at 65, and so they've added a bridge benefit to bridge you to when Canada Pension would start without a penalty. And they have in their plan terms and in their funding policy a post-retirement indexing provision, whereas if the funding can provide for post-retirement indexing, the trustees of the plan can, and in some cases are required, to provide post-indexing to plan members after retirement. Okay. I don't think under the Queen's plan a pensioner has ever gotten an increase in their pension. Since they get their same pension they're receiving today is the pension they received when they retired, whether that was 5, 10, 15, 20 years ago. So what does that mean on contributions? Most employees will have slightly lower contributions. The contribution rate under the PSSP is 8.4% on earnings up to that YMPE, up to the $57,000 level, and 10.9% on earnings over. So somebody who's earning $55,000 will see an improvement, a lower contribution rate under the PSSP versus the Queen's plan. Somebody who's earning $100,000 will slightly see a slight increase in the contribution rate. The contribution rate for the municipality overall will go down based on the current funding of the PSSP. Under the PSSP, employers match employee contributions. So right now under the Queen's plan, the employer is paying 1% more than employees. But the PSSP, it's a match, and always will be a match. It's defined in the in the plan documents that it will be a match. So I'm going to back up a little bit. So the PSSP, the Public Service Superannuation Plan, originally was the pension plan for provincial civil servants, various provincial agencies, boards, commissions, anything that sort of developed out of the provincial government or agencies that the provincial government has put together. It used to be that the Minister of Finance was the sole trustee of the pension plan. The minister had ultimate responsibility for the pension plan. It transitioned in 2010 to a board of trustees. And now the board of trustees has the ultimate fiduciary responsibility for the pension plan. The board of trustees, I think, is 13 members. 6 are appointed by the employer, the province as employer. 6 are appointed by various employee groups. In one of the appendices, there's sort of how that's all apportioned out. And then there's a chair that's appointed by the other trustees. So that's the 13. They are responsible for the final decisions on administration, on investment policy, all those sorts of things. They cannot change the plan terms outside of benefit improvements or benefit adjustments that might have to happen because of the funding of the plan. But they cannot, there's all kinds of things they cannot do. They can only do what the legislation tells them they can do. And one of the, they cannot, for example, change the 1.3 and 2 pension formula. Day-to-day plan administration and investment management is handled by a full-time organization, the Nova Scotia Pension Services Corporation. So that is an organization in Halifax. They've got about 65 employees, and all they do is run pension plans, administer pension plans. That's their sole responsibility. They've got, about a 10-person investment team, 30-odd pension administration staff, and then other sort of types of other ancillary employees. But that's all they do. They run the PSSP, the teacher's pension plan, also look after Cisco and the MLA's plan. So that's their sole responsibility. They are actually a not-for-profit corporation who's 50% owned by the PSSP trustees and 50% owned by the teacher's pension plan trustees. So they have a board of directors who come from the trustee groups, and they aren't sort of government employees directly, and are owned by those two trustee organizations. So the plan used to be, prior to 2010, just like yours, a traditional DB pension plan. Employees made a contribution, employers matched that contribution. If that plan ever wound up, can't imagine it would have, but if it ever wound up, the province was on the hook, and the province would have to make good on any deficit in the pension fund. It is now considered a jointly trusteed target benefit plan, where once the employer makes a contribution and employee makes a contribution, that's the end of their obligation. Okay? If the plan were to ever wind up, they would take those assets and apportion them out to plan members, and whatever assets are in the fund, that would be what would be distributed to plan members. There is no extra obligation on the employers to fully fund anything on wind up, although I can't imagine the plan would ever wind up. And the plan has, there are very strong sort of rules in terms of what would happen and what the trustees have to do when there is a deficit and how they would bring that deficit back to 100% funded. So they can't just let the thing run out, get down to 60, 50, 40% funded and say, cross our fingers. They are required by legislation to do things when the plan is in deficit. And actually in that same appendix, there's a little table of what they do depending upon what the funded level of the pension plan is. And I think we'll chat about it a little bit more as we go through. So as I mentioned, the plan design targets a defined benefit, meaning they intend to provide a pension benefit equal to 1.3% of earnings up to that YMPE and 2% over. But the plan document, the plan text, the act, the act of the legislature, which defines the plan, allows the trustees to improve benefits if there is a surplus, and requires them to do things if there is a deficit. Okay, and what they can do, and in both the surplus and deficit situation, is contained in that governing legislation. So they can't just do what they want. It says you shall do this, or you may do that. The plan actually has some rate stability built into it. The contributions, like under the Queen's plan, are greater than the cost of benefits. So that volatility that we tried to get rid of through that rate stability approach also applies and is followed under the PSSP. However, the trustees can ask for more contributions if the contributions aren't enough to extinguish a deficit over 10 years. Okay, so every 5 years they do some measurements of the plan, how the plan is doing and what the funded status of the plan. They do annual valuations, but every 5 years the trustees are required to do a deep dive into the funded status of the plan to determine the benefits and contributions for the following 5 years. The next one will be in 2020, the next sort of review on that basis. But based on the current contribution rates, I think the current contributions could absorb a deficit of about 6.2%. So they could be 94% funded and still not have to increase contributions, because there's enough extra contribution to support a deficit of about 6.2% of assets. So just because they go into a deficit doesn't necessarily mean there needs to be a contribution increase. It would have to be a pretty significant deficit before they would do that. So that was on the downside. They can require them to increase contributions, and if the funded ratio gets really bad, they can adjust contribution. They can adjust, we'll get to that in a second, they can adjust benefits, but they can't do some things. Anyway, so when the plan does have a funding excess, the first thing they can do is provide indexing. Okay, and if the funded ratio is 110% or less, the only thing they can do is provide indexing. They can't improve any other benefits. It's only if the funded ratio gets over about 110% that they could do other things, improve other types of benefits, reduce contributions. Okay? So they cannot sort of at 102% decide to do a bunch of things and other than a little bit of indexing to pensioners. When the plan is in a deficit recovery mode, they may be required to increase contributions, but as I mentioned, there is enough wiggle room in the contribution rate now to cover some level of deficit. Otherwise, they can adjust contributions upward and or adjust benefits. Okay? But one of the things they cannot do is reduce accrued benefits, meaning they cannot reduce the dollar amount of a pension, what a pensioner is receiving. The trustees cannot. If a pensioner is receiving a $10,000 pension per annum, the trustees and the fund and the plan is in a deficit, they cannot reduce the amount of that pension. They could suspend indexing, but they can't reduce the dollar of the dollar amount of pension. They also can't reduce the accrued pension to an active member. So if you've accrued a $10,000 pension, they cannot reduce the amount of that pension. What they can do, potentially, is change when it could be paid. They could change that age 60 unreduced pension to 62 or 63. They could change that rule of 80, rule of 85. They potentially could change like a survivor benefit, like what a spouse would get should the, could a pensioner pass away. A future pensioner, not one that's already receiving their pension. But they cannot reduce the dollar amount of the pension that somebody has accrued. Okay, the trustee does not have the authority to do that. So the whole point of this defunding benefits policy is to encourage risk sharing between the plan members and the employer and to provide flexibility for long-term success, right? So they have the ability to adjust some benefits, to adjust contributions, to provide indexing, to provide some benefit improvements if the funding allows for that. So what does that mean? So one of the things, big things of the PSSP, it's big, right? You've got $12.2 million in assets. They've got $6.3 billion in assets in their pension fund, okay? So they can do some things that you can't do. They can invest, their investment horizon, their investment, the types of assets they can invest in are way different than a plan that's $12.2 million. Okay? So they have opportunities that aren't available to you for investment. Infrastructure, for example, real estate, you know, actually buying buildings, things like that. They can do those sorts of things. You can't do that with $12.2 million. Since it's such a big plan, they're actually their per unit cost as percentage of assets is much lower than yours. So what that means is more dollars of every contribution more of every contribution dollar is going to member benefits and less is going to administer, run the pension fund. The other sort of, I would think, positive of a plan like the PSSP is there is that dedicated plan administration corporation. That's all they do. Their sole focus is administering, investing pension fund assets for employee, for Nova Scotians. That's all they do. That's their single focus. What there is, you know, when you have your own pension plan, you control it. You can decide how you want it invested. You can decide what the benefits you want to provide. You have the ultimate authority under the pension fund. So if you're in the PSSP, they make the rules, right? If there's a dispute over, let's say, who joins, they decide, right? And you follow their rules. Okay, that could be a good or a bad thing depending upon, you know, how you look at it. So what's going? Why is this opportunity available to us right now? Available to you? One of the trustee goals that they put in their 5-year plan is to increase the active membership of the pension plan. Okay, that is, they want to make their plan bigger. For reasons like size helps them in enhance their investment opportunity. They'd like to have more assets to invest. They feel they can provide a service to other plans in Nova Scotia. So that one of the trustee goals is to look at, is to increase the active membership of the plan, and they are actively pursuing or providing the opportunity for public sector entities in Nova Scotia to join with them. The provincial government is supporting this through legislation, right? The Pension Benefits Act, as it reads, would make it very difficult, if not impossible, for you guys to join with the PSFP. So there is special legislation that supports these kind of transfers. And one is called the University Pension Plan Transfer Act. That was done in 2015 to allow for universities to join with the PSSP. And the other one is the Municipal and Other Authorities Pension Plan Transfer Act, which was enacted in late 2016 to allow organizations like yours to join with the PSSP. And it sets out the rules and how a transfer would occur, what sort of conditions that the trustee needs to meet in order to allow for a transfer in. So lots of plans have already transferred. There's a list, about a dozen plans that have transferred in. Some in this area, South Shore Public Libraries are now, employees of the South Shore Public Libraries are now members of the PSSP. Lots of universities there. Cape Breton Regional Municipality joined a year and a half ago. So all employees of CBRM are now members of the PSSP. Two other municipal groups, County of Pictou, Village of Bible Hill. Riverview Enhanced Living is in Day Spring. They joined earlier this year, the PSSP. So you'll see a number of universities there, a number of other organizations, and I know of a number of groups who are actively pursuing this and are going through a process like this in order to determine whether or not it makes sense to them to join the PSSP. So just think things to think about as we talk through this sort of thing. And we've talked about some of these things before, but you know, here's some of the key issues, reasons, that things to think about when considering whether or not the PSSP is the right pension plan for employees of Queens. It does have a different benefit and contribution structure, right? If you were to join the PSSP, they set the contribution rate. If they say the contribution rate's going up by 0.5% per annum, or per, you know, 0.5% of pay, you pay it. You can't say no, thank you. We'd like to stick with the old contribution rate. But is the current plan sustainable? Will it be affordable when the new pension legislation comes into effect? You know, the PSSP is administered by a third-party organization. That's all they do. You know, I'm sure staff here have better things to do some days than to deal with the pension plan. As we mentioned before, is it feasible, sustainable for a municipality of the size of Queens in order to run their own defined benefit pension plan? One of the things that from an employer perspective, you know, contribution rates, pension plan, is again, as since it's the trustees who set the plan, it's removed from the collective bargaining process. Right now, in order to change contributions rates, that would be, has to go through sort of collective bargaining. Right now, the 8.8%, any changes to the pension plan are the subject of bargaining. But remember, as I mentioned, industrial contributions can be mandated by both the trustee and the employer, or by the trustee from both members and employer. And benefits could be adjusted downwards if the funded ratio does deteriorate. But as I mentioned earlier, accrued benefits are protected. So let's compare the plans just a little bit. Okay, as I mentioned before, so both of these comparators are at December 31st, 2018. So both plans did evaluation at December 31st, 2018. The Queens plan has a market value of assets of $12.2 million. The PSSP market value of assets, $6.3 billion. They would sneeze $12.2 million in investment gains and losses in a half an hour, right? The Queens plan is just tiny in their world. The payroll, so the payroll that's supporting this plan, is about $3.7 million at Queens, about $1.2 billion. So that's, if contribution rates had to go up, that's how much how much payroll those contribution rates are spread over, right? So doesn't take, when you got $1.2 billion in payroll, it doesn't need a very big increase to generate a fair bit of money, right? So again, size helps the plan, the plan when it's in a deficit situation to generate contributions, funding, in order to meet those requirements. The PSSP doesn't have to do any kind of solvency or wind-up test, but under the Queen's plan, there is a solvency exemption, but the plan is significantly underfunded on a wind-up basis. I think about $3 million. Sort of if the plan were to wind up, there's an obligation to fund about $3 million of liabilities. The funded ratio, as Jen mentioned, of the Queen's plan at December 31st, 2018, on a market value basis, is 100%. Got a surplus of about $8,000. The funded ratio of the PSSP on that date was about 98%, but it improved. They do quarterly updates, and at March 31st, they were back over, well over 100%, I think about 102%. So that's how much improvement they got in that three-month period. And finally, the number of members. So there's 78 active and LTD members in the Queen's plan, and about 34 pensioners and others who have a right to benefits under the plan. Under the PSSP, there's a little over 17,000 active and disabled members, and a little over 17,000 pensioners. Again, a large group of employees in order to spread any issues in terms of deficits or problems around. So it's just way bigger than your pension plan. And we've already gone through, so employee contributions, 8.8% of earnings for the Queen's employees, 9.8% for the employer. So based on that $3.7 million of payroll, we expect the contributions this year to be around $362,000 based on that $3.7 million of payroll. Under the PSSP, there's that break point at 57.4 and employers match. The employer contribution to the PSSP based on that same $3.7 million of payroll would be around $321,000. So there would be a contribution saving of about $40,000 a year for the employer under the PSSP. And an employee who was earning around $45,000, their contributions would decrease by around $180 a year. So on the contribution rate, so we've done a little, what's the differences, some of the positives, concerns, PSSP versus Queen's. So under the PSSP, the total contributions are in excess of the current service cost. So same thing, your rate stability approach applies under the PSSP. The cost of their benefits is around 12.8% of payroll versus 17.6% contribution. So there's about 4.8% of payroll to absorb demographic changes to the plan membership, and deficit recovery. And any change to funding is shared 50-50 between the employer and employee. Just that's the way the legislation is written. And of course, provincial governments have exempted their own plan from the legislation, so all of this funding reform doesn't apply to them. So under the Queen's pension plan, as we mentioned earlier, the contributions are slightly in excess of service costs, so there's about a 1% buffer there. And that if those total contributions were insufficient to meet the minimum requirements, it's up to the employer to make up the difference. You cannot change employee contributions through a collective bargaining process. And as we mentioned again, we expect the minimum requirements to increase to above the current total contributions under the new pension funding reform. How does this play out? What happens? How does the trustee accept transfers from other pension plans? So the key principle that the PSSP trustees have is that any transfer in must be cost neutral to the current members of the PSSP. What that means is the funded ratio, the funded position of their pension plan, cannot be less after the transfer compared to the minute before the transfer. If they were 102% funded before the transfer, they are necessarily 102% funded after the transfer. And the other principle they have is that it's up to the transferring in plan to pay all the costs related to the transfer. That includes their costs, their actuarial fees, their legal fees, their costs for administrative system updates, all those sorts of things. So they're more than happy to have you, but you're going to pay to get there, right? The transfer is not of the accrued pension. The transfer is of your accumulated service for active plan members. So if you have 10 years of service in the Queen's plan, you would have 10 years of service under the PSSP, calculated in accordance with the PSSP formulas and payable under the PSSP rules. Okay? But the transfer agreement, the agreement on to transfer benefits into the PSSP, can provide for a minimum benefit in respect of the service transferred such that you will never get less than what you've accrued in the Queen's pension plan. So regardless of what the formula calculates under the PSSP, your pension for the 10 years in my example that you transfer in will never be less than what you accrued under the Queen's pension plan. So if you've accrued a pension of $10,000 under the Queen's plan and for the 10 years of service that you were in the Queen's pension plan, regardless and at the time you retire, the PSSP formula is $9,500 for those same 10 years of service, your pension, you will receive no less than $10,000. It's all priced into the transfer, but it's a guarantee that you will not receive less than what you've accrued under the Queen's pension plan. For pensioners and deferred members, so deferred members are those people who have left but still have an entitlement to benefits under the Queen's pension plan. So for pensions in pay, so those who are receiving pensions today, they will receive exactly the same dollar amount of pension under the PSSP in exactly the same form of pension as they've gotten under the Queen's pension plan. So if they have a form where they receive a 60% survivor benefit under the Queen's pension plan, under the PSSP, they will receive exactly the same amount of pension in a form that provides a 60% survivor pension to your spouse. But you'll be subject to and eligible for the indexing that all other PSSP pensioners receive. Deferred pensions will be payable under the terms of the PSSP at the date that they're payable under the PSSP. So for those half a dozen members who have a deferred pension under the Queen's plan, they're actually getting a good deal. Their pension under the Queen's plan is payable at 65. Their pension under the PSSP will be payable at 60. But it's exactly the same amount of pension that was payable under the Queen's pension plan. So how this all happens is the PSSP will calculate, here's how much money we want from the Queen's pension plan in order to fund all of these benefits under the terms of the PSSP. And those assets from the Queen's pension plan would be transferred to the PSSP to support the transfer. Okay, so for every individual, they would calculate how much is required in order to credit that number of years of service. How much would be required to transfer those pensions and deferred pensions, and that's all determined by the PSSP trustee and their actuaries in accordance with the assumptions that are part of this transfer agreement that would be negotiated. So here's a couple of examples, okay, that shows how this would play out for a couple of sample plan members. So as I mentioned, the accrued pensions at the date of transfer could be smaller than under the Queen's pension plan, because under the Queen's plan, the formula is 1.3% of earnings, or sorry, under the PSSP, the formula is 1.3% of earnings up to that YMPE, whereas under the Queen's plan, it's 2%, right? So potentially, it could be lower, potentially, particularly for members who haven't had very big salary increases, right? If their earnings are pretty flat, they will not have as big an accrued pension under the PSSP as they did under the Queen's pension plan. But remember, there is a guarantee. right? We could price in, we can offer, we can provide a guarantee that the pension for those years of service will not be less than what they accrued under the Queen's plan. So nobody loses on day one, okay? But you really can't, there's other things other than the dollar amount of pension that provides value under the pension plan. There's the final average component in the PSSP that always happens. So while they might have a lower pension on day one, on the date of transfer, their pension for those 10 years of Queen's service actually grows every year as their final average earnings grows. There are different early retirement rules, which means they might be able to retire earlier under the PSSP than they could under the Queen's plan. There's that extra pension that's payable to age 65 under the PSSP that isn't payable under the Queen's plan. And then there's a value to that post-retirement indexing. So it's kind of difficult just to use pension amount as the comparator. There's other things under the PSSP which provide value which might be greater than under the Queen's pension plan. So we did some testing based on the 2017 data. We didn't update it based on the 2018, but we did it based on the 2017 data. Okay? And on day one, most pensions for plan members were a little bit lower under the PSSP, using the PSSP formula versus the Queen's formula. Okay? The formula test, the formula calculation was a little bit lower. Okay? But remember, we've got that minimum benefit provision, which guarantees that they would not receive less than what they received on what they're receiving under the Queen's plan for their Queen's service. The average reduction was about 25%. Some were less, some were more. And on average, it would take, with reasonable salary growth, it would take about 10 years for the PSSP formula with the final average to kind of overtake the Queen's calculation. Okay? And repeating again, the early retirement bridge benefits and post-retirement indexing isn't in the Queen's plan, that's potentially in the PSSP. So here's my example number one. So here's John Smith, who's now age 60, has 15 years of service, and for example, let's assume that his Queen's pension is $13,400 a year. If we just followed the PSSP formula based on his final average earnings of $50,500, his PSSP formula by calculation would be $9,848. Okay, but if he retired at age 60, he would also receive a bridge benefit under the PSSP, and that bridge benefit would be $5,302. So his total benefit under the PSSP for service up to, for his total benefit under the PSSP payable up to age 65 would actually be $15,150 versus $13,400 under the Queen's plan. And after age 65, it would be $13,400, his Queen's pension, because again, we're going to guarantee that you never receive less than what you were accrued under the Queen's plan for your Queen's years of service. So this person under the Queen's plan, under the PSSP, and if he retired at age 60, would earn about $1,700 more a year for the 5 years between 60 and 65, and then no less than what he would have gotten under the Queen's plan thereafter. Jane Brown. So she's 45 with same 15 years of service, exactly the same pension, $13,400. So on the date, and she's got exactly the same earnings history as Joe, John?
He was John.
John.
That guy was John, yeah.
She would, again, on the date of transfer, would have accrued a pension of $9,848 and a bridging benefit payable to age 65 of $5,302. But Jane's not retiring right now. She's going to hang on for another 15 years, right? She's going to stay till she's 60. If she retires at 60, for those years, those 15 years that she was in the Queen's plan, she would have accrued a pension of $13,400. That's not going to change, right? Because it's based on your earned 2% of your earnings in the year, right? Under the PSSP, if we assume that her salary grew by 2.5% a year, her final average earnings would grow, the final average YMP would grow, we would calculate that again. She would have accrued now a pension of $14,254. Plus, she'd also get the bridge benefit of $7,676. So her total amount for those 15 years of service, payable when she retires at age 60, would be $21,930, which would then go down at age 65 to $14,254. Both numbers in excess of what she would have gotten under the Queen's pension plan. So she's doing great all around. The final average component of the PSSP has grown her pension to be greater than what she accrued under the Queen's pension plan for those Queens, those 15 years of Queen's pension. So nobody earns less. If the PSSP formula gets more, provides more, member gets more. So here's just a summary, right? So the only issue is that 9848 for John for those for this post 65, and we've priced into the transfer that can't be less than 13.4. So nobody, I think the key thing, nobody would receive less than what they've accrued under the Queen's pension plan for those Queen's years of service. I keep repeating that. So financially, can we do this? Is there enough money in the Queen's pension plan in order to allow for this to happen? So I'll cut to the chase, yes. So what we did after we completed the 2018 member statements and worked on was working on the pension plan, the valuation at December 31st, 2018, we also sent member data to the PSSP and asked them to do a preliminary pricing, costing of what it would, what they would think the value of how much it would, they would want in order to take on all the Queen's plan liabilities. And remember that the key metric that the PSSP trustees use is that the funded ratio must be cost neutral, right? That they cannot, the funded ratio of the PSSP after the transfer can't be less than the funded ratio of the PSSP before the transfer. Okay? So based on that, as I mentioned, it's feasible. For every year of service you had in the Queen's plan, you would get 1 year of service under the PSSP. All benefits earned under the Queen's plan would be fully protected. And at the end of the day, based on this preliminary costing, there's about $875,000 left over. Okay. So all assets could, all benefits could be transferred. Everybody receives at least what they received under the PSSP, under the Queen's plan for those years of service, and there's still $875,000 left over. So one thing that this doesn't, there's two. Being an actuary, I've got to give you the cautionary notes now. Two things that aren't in that calculation. It doesn't include any expenses, any costs related to doing the transfer. So as I mentioned earlier, all PSSP expenses based on, related to the transition will be charged to the Queen, to Queens. So that's legal, actuarial, admin. And then the cost to Queens to do the transfer, to review documents, to have legal review of the transfer agreement. We typically get involved in data transfers, in reviewing the final costings that the PSSP actuaries do to make sure that we believe that they make sense to us and that that everything looks fine. That could easily be $100,000 or more, easily. So that kind of plays into sort of that $875,000 extra sort of excess. The other thing is that was a point in time test, right? As at December 31st, 2018. Any divergence in the funded ratios between that and the date the actual transition would happen also would be factored in by the PSSP trustees. Okay, so let's say they do wonderfully well in their funding, in their plan, and are 108% funded on the date that the transition actually happens. You have to fund up to 108%. Okay? Now, hopefully your plan is also grown, and maybe your plan is also 108% funded at that time, but maybe it isn't. Maybe yours is only 105. Then you've got to make that difference between the 105 and 108 in cash. We've done some testing. It would have to be a massive divergence that the 875 wouldn't be enough to cover off that. So in my mind, there's low risk, not zero risk, but low risk that those assets would diverge. And once you, if this was going to happen, if it looked like this was a done deal and there was going to be a transition, but maybe it's not going to happen because of whatever reason for 6 months after you kind of decided that, yes, we want to go down this road, we would suggest that we change the asset mix of the Queen's plan to better match what the asset mix of the PSSP is. Can't match it exactly, but if they were 30% equities, I'd suggest you guys move to 30% equities in order that any change in their asset mix gets as best can reflected in your plan as well. And that would reduce the volatility and the risk of that mismatch happening. So what would happen from here? As I mentioned earlier, there's a pension benefit, there's that Municipal and Other Authorities Pension Transfer Act, which would be the act which governs how this would happen. One of the requirements of that act is that there be a vote of plan members. Okay? And the support of the majority of plan members, active, deferred, and retirees would be a majority of those who vote would have to support the transfer. Just because they vote yes doesn't mean it has to happen. The Municipality of Queens, as the plan sponsor, as the organization, the group that would sign the transfer agreement, has final say. But if there was not a support of the majority of plan members, it stops, right? You can't move forward. Okay? A positive vote doesn't mean that it necessarily happens, but it's one of the goalposts you need to go through in order to move to the next step, which is negotiate a transfer agreement. So you could have a positive support from a vote, but you, as the plan sponsors, could at the end of the day say no. Right? But if the vote is negative, then it doesn't matter whether or not the municipality wanted to move forward or not, you can't. Then once you have that support of the majority of plan members, and it's everybody, it's not sort of each group, you know, you've got, there'd be 100 plus eligible voters, the 78 actives and the 30 odd retirees. You just need a majority of those who actually cast a ballot to meet that requirement. Then you would negotiate a transfer agreement between the PSSP trustees and the region. We say negotiate. Really, they've got a template that they want to use. They hold all the cards. The negotiation are things like, what's the transfer date? Whether or not there'd be that minimum guarantee. Other than that, it's kind of, yeah, you're coming to our party. You know, you play by our rules kind of thing. So then there's some other items that we put here with question marks. You know, there'll be a communication with plan members that I think is going out this week, potentially.
October the 1st.
Okay, next week. Some information sessions next week.
Yes.
To just introduce this to plan members. Haven't really thought about timing of a vote, but I guess after those information sessions, we'll get a sense as to how this is going and whether or not it makes sense to have that vote or not. As we mentioned here, support of union leadership is very helpful, and so far that has happened. We've had one meeting to introduce this to the pension committee and some of the union leadership, and it seemed pretty positive from their perspective at this point. And then the other question we have there is what, if any, changes to collective agreements might be required in order to make this happen. Right now, I think in some of the collective agreements, it says the Municipality of Queens pension plan. So those would have to change in order to kind of move out of that plan and into the PSSP. So I've done a lot of talking. You guys must have some questions. Happy to answer any and all the questions you guys might have regarding this.
Comments or questions of counselors on this presentation?
Wow. Okay. So,
yes,
Counselor,
are we going to open up questions to the people that are really affected, or
Well, I'm going to ask a question of Jennifer because I don't know if Jennifer would like to have the personal questions come to her or share with Eckler, because we are on an audio recording, and I would caution anyone that they should not be discussing any personal specific issues financially on the audio. So I just want to make sure that we're getting around that as we move forward today.
So basically, we do have a lot of information going out in the employee pay stuff on Thursday. We set up the employee communication meetings for October the 1st, Tuesday. We're meeting with the unions and the union prospective members and all the administration staff as well. The positive takes from here are, we know that there are pension regulation changes coming forward in the next few months. We know that these are going to happen. They're going to adversely affect our rates. We will require an increase to our contribution rates. We have been sustainable all this time, yes, but we are a $12 million plan, and the PSSP is a $6 billion plan. There's 17,000 actively contributing members in that PSSP plan, as opposed to our 112. So even if there were changes in the investment portfolios or how their investments were performing, the need to increase contributions because of additional costs in their plan would be spread over 17,000 members as opposed to our 112 members. So there'd be very little impact, even though, yes, they do control completely the contribution rates and those would be dictated to us. That would be spread over 17,000 people. The PSSP plan has a contribution rate requirement of the employer of 8.4%, and right now the region of Queens is 9.8%. So there's a savings right off the get-go for the region of Queens on the tax rate. Even though there are some that are slightly higher, the averages out to about $50,000 a year, and that again is before we get to the new plan regulations that are going to cause our costs to increase and our contribution rates to have to increase by that 1.6%. This negotiation piece, which we didn't know of last year or the year before when we started investigating this transfer, the fact that we can transfer all of our prior year's service and retain all of the service earned is huge. We did not have that guarantee when we were looking at this previously. So we will all retain the current benefits and our defined benefits as they stand today going forward in this plan. And that's part of the formula and part of the costing. And so when PSSP does their costing and they say that the assets are enough to cover that, is that purchase, that's the purchase of that prior year's service. So that $875,000 surplus is huge in that it affords us that ability to purchase all that prior year's service so nobody loses any of the current earned benefits. And then the additional money is there to cover those costs. Where it's $875,000 surplus, and that is more than the cost will be for this transfer, that allows us that buffer because we know it's going to take time to prepare and complete this transfer. That gives us that buffer just in case our asset base doesn't do the same or doesn't perform the same as that PSSP plan does later on. So if their plan does better and their assets perform better than ours do, we still have a buffer here to ensure that there will be no cash outlays on the Region of Queens tax rate to purchase in this plan. The plan's assets will still be enough to cover this purchase. Highlights.
And thank you for that, because I think the question at hand was, will there be future meetings for employees and members of the plan to ask specific questions?
And all of that information will be reviewed with them on October the 1st.
And
I
so
meet specifically with the union reps and the shop stewards at 10 a.m. And then at 2:30 is the invite for the union members, and the union reps will be attending that meeting as well. And then at 4:30 this is administration and anyone who may have missed when we did the union consultation earlier in the afternoon, they're welcome to attend then at 4:30. So we make sure that everybody has the opportunity. And it's a multiple page communication that's going in the pay stubs this week, and everyone is free to come and ask me any questions.
So the briefing today is for the benefit of council as
correct,
well as those that attend. At this point, do you, Jennifer, have anything additional to add to the presentation today?
You know, the only thing I'd add is, in my mind, this seems to be a win-win. for both sides. I think it's a win for the municipality, right? It's a win from the municipality in terms of a cost and future stability, being able to provide a defined benefit, type benefit, mm-hmm. to its plan members, to its employees. It's a win, I think, for plan members in getting into a plan that is going to be sustainable, going to be around for 100
safety
years.
Safety in numbers.
Safe size-wise and all that kind of stuff. We've been involved in a number of these over the last little while, and most have come to that kind of conclusion, that it's been, you know, growing pains to get to that point. Lots of things that make it a lot of work to get from deciding to get into the PSSP, but once they're in and contributing, I think they all think that that it was worth the effort.
And that PSSP plan is managed by a board of trustees. There's a certain expertise and education required to be on that board of trustees. So we removed that piece from, you know, the volatile pension committee, the members change council, the members change. We've got that added security that board of trustees know what they're doing, and they're vested as well. I mean, they have members from various employers that are stakeholders at the table in this board of trustees. So, and then they have that education and expertise, so they know exactly what they're doing, and that is their full-time job, is to appropriately and properly manage those pension assets.
Thank you, Jennifer. I have a question by Deputy Mayor Kelly.
Just remind me, Eckler, you're our pension plan, Region of Peace Pension Plan advisor or administrator?
Well, we're the small A administrator. So you are the administrator as defined in the pension benefits legislation.
They're
our actuaries. We're a third-party service provider who provides administration services,
right.
Which means
and advice.
So that means if somebody terminates or retires, we'll do the calculations for you.
So yeah. What is your role after this transfer?
We lose you as a client.
Right.
They no longer get the benefit of our service charges.
And my second question is, what is the timeline for these provincial funding changes to pension funding?
Our best guess was that it was going to be introduced in the fall and be effective in 2020. Whether or not that means on January 1st, 2020 or December 31st, 2020, not sure. But
how does that affect any changes? This is obviously not going to be overnight.
Right.
This process takes
so
time.
You would have to, we'll have to file a valuation at December 31st, 2019.
Yep.
Under whatever rules are in place at that time.
So if they did go ahead with this, if it was all voted and it was all a okay, thumbs up from everybody, and then as long as you started this process, you will be under the rules of the PSSP?
No, not until the transfer date, which likely wouldn't be, my bet is we're looking at next summer.
Right.
Right, at the earliest.
There is the option for us to make a special request from the superintendent of pensions because we're during the transition has been approved and it is in process and it is likely to happen. Then we have the benefit of not having to adhere to those new rules right away, and we have the postponement of adhering to those rules.
Yeah.
But that will have to be a special request, but
or
the superintendent is easy to get along with.
She's very reasonable, I'd say. So she is. Like,
right.
she knows what's going on, so.
And the other thing is they have said there's going to be a transition to the new rules. This 1.6% is what we think the ultimate point will be. It may be that the first point of transition are 17.6 or 18.6 number is okay.
Right.
It may be the second year that it's not.
Okay.
Right? So I think, you know, should it may very well be that we're okay for December 2019. Or that any change that would come out of that December 2019 isn't effective until January 1, 2021. So that there's all kinds of things that I don't think we likely are okay for in the next 12 months, but after that I think I'm less confident that things will be okay.
Okay.